This is the story of a tragedy on top of a tragedy.
1:25 this morning here in Atlanta at Centennial Park, there was an explosive device. It does now appear that it was some kind of a crude bomb.
A story of a hero turned villain.
The hero security guard who found the Olympic Park bomb in Atlanta now emerges
which
as
exploded
the
explosion of the city's...
And an investigation in search of a suspect.
The fact that two of the largest institutions in our country, the FBI and the media, make the mistake and essentially join forces to ruin his life, makes this an American tragedy.
I'm Virginia Prescott with an On Second Thoughts special, Mistaken, the real story of Richard Jewell. In the late 90s and early aughts, the name Richard Jewell became a newsroom watchword, code for false accusations and a warning against rushing to judgment when reporting on criminal investigations. The public humiliation of Jewell and his mother are at the center of Richard Jewell, a new movie from director Clint Eastwood.
All right, Richard, here's what we're going to do.
We need a voice exemplar.
I want you to say into this phone, there's a bomb in Centennial Park. You have 30 minutes.
But as we know, Hollywood doesn't always get it right. Kevin Salwin and Kent Alexander were there, and they consulted with Eastwood. Salwin was editor for the Wall Street Journal's coverage of the 96 games. Kent Alexander was U.S. attorney for Northern Georgia at the time and worked with the FBI on the case. Together, they wrote the book The Suspect. It's a cautionary tale of ambitions outrunning humanity and begins in a city with a chip on its shoulder. Here's Kevin Salwin.
Well, Atlanta in 1987 was very much a striving city. It was a city of salesmen, as it was often known. It was a city that where the best restaurants were in strip malls. It was a city in which, from a sports perspective, it was known and actually called by Sports Illustrated as Loserville, USA.
The campaign to host the centennial anniversary of the modern games was a long shot that began in 1987. Business and government leaders wanted the world to see Atlanta as a post-racial city and the capital of the New South.
For the city of Atlanta to be striving to get the Olympic Games was kind of, in many ways, a very absurd notion.
For the last 4 years and gotten behind it, as you heard Commissioner Lomax say early, it has been the spirit of the people that has made the difference. And I have to tell you, as we await the next hour, an hour that I think will be the most important in the history of this city since General Sherman marched through here.
Kent Alexander says to win the Games, Olympic boosters wanted to show they were tough on crime.
Crime was a big problem in Atlanta. I was U.S. attorney at the time. We were known in some circles the homicide capital of the world. In reality, the city was cleaning up pretty well, and particularly as the Olympics came, we cleaned up a lot more. And beyond the crime on the streets, there's the terrorism piece. Oklahoma City had occurred not long before. The sarin gas attacks in Japan had occurred. So we had to worry, law enforcement, about what to do about making sure that that did not happen in Atlanta.
The International Olympic Committee has awarded the 1996 Olympic Games to the city of Atlanta.
Winning the Olympics was entirely unexpected by a lot of people.
Ken Alexander says once the city won the Games, there were a lot of raised eyebrows. What was Atlanta's plan?
In fact, somebody at the hotel in Japan when it was won said, okay, now the dog has caught the car. Now what?
Now what indeed? Atlanta at the time had 2,500 cops on the payroll and needed to amp up security fast for what was predicted to be the largest peacetime gathering in history, a massive and visible international event. So they brought in police from all over the state and beyond.
Federal law enforcement, we brought in a lot of FBI agents, DEA agents, ATF agents, and the military. So ultimately, there were about 30,000 security personnel in Atlanta specifically to secure the games.
Among those 30,000, Richard Jewell, hired a month before the games began. Kevin Salwin.
Well, Richard was very much a mixed bag. He was in many ways a terrific rural police officer, but Richard was often a little bit more zealous than people wanted him to be. When he was at the Habersham County Sheriff's Office, he would wreck vehicles.
And he would lose jobs. Joel's lifelong dream of becoming a cop bordered on an obsession and was derailed by an arrest for impersonating an officer. Piedmont College let him go after he repeatedly pulled citizens over off campus.
And so he came to Atlanta as part of this security force, basically to resuscitate his career and to wait for the possibility of other police jobs to reopen because nobody was going to hire before the game.
So at the games, his assignment was to guard this one sound and light tower. But because he was a little overzealous, a little over the top, he treated the entire tower as his domain, and he was going to protect that entire tower, which was so unusual in the field of private security, but that was Richard Jewell.
It was a pretty uneventful job until the day it wasn't. Just after midnight on July 27th, something like 50,000 revelers were at a concert at Centennial Park, and Richard Jewell was making his rounds.
So he was going around, and he came across a group of kids drinking, and they're shotgunning Budweisers. And he took offense at that. He was trying to get them out of there, and they wouldn't leave. So he flagged down a GBI agent named Tom Davis to get him to get them out of there.
Unbeknownst to Jewell, at 12:58 a.m., an anonymous 911 call had come in, warning of a bomb in Centennial Park.
The package, the Alice pack, a military pack that held a bomb, was hidden under a bench right next to the tower. Richard Jewell's the one who pointed to it after the kids left and said, "That shouldn't be there."
Richard runs up and down the tower to tell people, give people a pre-warning. Hey, there's a suspicious package. We may have a problem.
So they called for help.
Two bomb techs, one from ATF, one from FBI, come in, wind their way through the crowd, crawl up, look at the package. They're not supposed to touch it, but one of them does open the lip of it. And Richard's watching them as the guy's got a pen light, and the guy sees wires and pipes and suddenly realizes this is the real thing.
As soon as Richard realizes, yes, this is actually a bomb, he races back in the tower. It's literally pushing people down the stair to try to save their lives.
So I was at home at sleep. My friend Jim Green, who's watching CNN, calls and says, "Hey, do you know about this?"
They're carrying somebody away right here in front of the AT&T Olympic Village. It's 1:20. There was a, we don't know where the...
And so I got dressed immediately. I showered because I just had the sense I wouldn't be back home for a while. I drove straight to the FBI and then along with the head of the ATF, drove to the park. And by that point, yeah, everybody was evacuated. And the 111 victims, all out of there, except that Alice Hawthorne, Mrs. Hawthorne's body, was still laying where it was, right in front of the Greek sculpture.
Alice Hawthorne was killed by the blast. A Turkish cameraman died from a heart attack covering the aftermath. Many of the injured were police and security officers who formed a perimeter around the bomb.
So I met Richard that morning, and I went over to shake his hand and to thank him for what he did. I just remember shaking his hand, and he said, "Sir, I was just doing my job."
Just doing my job. It's a line Jewell would often use in the days after the bombing. With the eyes of the world on Atlanta, the entire U.S. Justice Department kicked into high gear with one task in mind: finding the Centennial Park bomber. And that meant keeping a close eye on Richard Jewell, because you always look at the person who found the bomb.
So Richard, for the first couple of days, was doing two things primarily. Number one is he was doing interviews with law enforcement.
And he was talking to reporters.
He did a couple of CNN interviews. He did some newspaper interviews.
The reporters Jewell talked to were part of a brand new media landscape just beginning to take shape.
1996 is a fascinating year in media. And so CNN's already up and running, but Fox News Channel starts up that year. MSNBC starts up that year.
You're connected to MSNBC.
Several publications, major publications, go online for the first time. So the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Chicago Tribune all go online for the first time in 96. And now all of a sudden, the pace of media, the pace of news starts to completely change. And with that, the pressures in newsroom completely ratchet up. The public's expectation for when they should receive information completely starts to shift.
And so the promise of a constant flow of news began to collide headlong into what was arguably the biggest news story in the world.
Well, the media was, as you would expect, attempting to figure out who did this and attempting to figure out where law enforcement is. There were 15,000 journalists who were credentialed for the Olympic Games. So there was a swarm of media. Most of them were sports reporters, and most of them had no experience in law enforcement, no sourcing in law enforcement. But one person in particular did.
Her name, Kathy Scruggs, a crime reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
She was, she's sexy, she's profane, she's a heavy drinker, a heavy smoker, she keeps a gun in her purse, you know, and loved to go to local haunts like Manuel's Tavern and hang out there with the homicide cops. But the cops loved her because she was actually a terrific reporter. Kathy was, in many ways, a throwback from the 1930s newspaper wars.
But this was 1996. In the 1930s, stories couldn't cross the world in the blink of an eye.
And Kathy said, one of her mottos was, "We're not in the business of being last." And then on the Tuesday morning,
3 days after Richard Jewell found the bomb in Centennial Park,
he does this interview with Katie Couric on the Today Show. And Katie Couric is, you know, America's sweetheart. This is a big deal. And so he's transported down there by limo. Katie Couric tells him how he's a hero. He really gives him a hero's welcome. What he doesn't know is that when he gets back in the limo on the way home, that the FBI is following him home.
By now, Jewell was the FBI's lead suspect in the case. His former employers at Habersham County and Piedmont College had seen him on TV and called the FBI tip line, warning that something was off with Richard Jewell, suggesting he was a wannabe cop, the type of guy to plant a bomb and then save people from the same bomb. A Los Angeles cop confessed to a similar ploy at the 84 Olympics. And at the same time, forensic psychologists at FBI headquarters had decided that sort of person looked a lot like Richard Jewell.
A parallel track to that was the behavioral science unit. They had crafted a profile, and it was part interview advice, how to interview Richard Jewell, and it was part saying, though this isn't a science and subjective and all of that, part of it was very much, this is your guy, he did it.
And that was what got leaked to the one reporter on the ground who had the drive and old school moxie to take it and run with it, Kathy Scruggs of the AJC. She's since passed away, but her editor, Bert Rotin, recently talked about it publicly for the first time in 23 years.
I've mostly been a reporter and was forced to be an editor when the Olympics came to town. The worst thing ever happened to me.
But editor he was, and here was Kathy Scruggs with the scoop everyone in the world was after. In Eastwood's film, Scruggs has an intimate relationship with her FBI source. There is no evidence of that actually happening.
And I won't comment on her sources. I won't even acknowledge that there was an FBI source, if there was one. But she got this tip, and then she sought to verify it. And she met with somebody who had very deep firsthand knowledge of the FBI, including an internal document that had profiled Richard Jewell as the bomber and explained why in this document, why he was seen as the bomber. And went through quite a bit of detail with her on why the FBI suspected him.
Scruggs took a day to get someone in law enforcement to corroborate the story and now had a scoop that could pass muster with her editors. She and colleague Ron Martz typed up the story, and still there was a lot of debate in the newsroom.
I will admit that at the time I was a little reluctant to name him. I went to our managing editor and I said, well, do we name him? And then he repeated back to me that we had the story, there's no question that it was accurate at that point. It had passed the journalistic test to be an accurate portrayal of reality.
And as Kathy Scruggs liked to say, the AJC wasn't in the business of being last. The story ran in a special afternoon edition of the AJC on Tuesday, July 30th, headlined, FBI Suspects Hero Guard May Have Planted Bomb.
I don't believe that there is a red-blooded American journalist who, in that same set of circumstances, wouldn't have gone ahead and published the story.
The editors ran it over to CNN, where Tom Johnson was head of news. And like the AJC, Johnson's newsroom had a decision to make.
Yes, it was talked over. Yes, there was a period there when we thought that naming him as the suspect was wrong. I mean, the old tradition has been you need to have at least two sources or more.
Johnson checked the Jewel story with his FBI source, who told him he's the guy. Plus, Johnson trusted the AJC.
We've been asked to relay the story to you verbatim, which we'll do.
So CNN ran with the story.
The security guard, and this is a quote from the Atlanta Journal, who first alerted police to the pipe bomb that exploded in...
On air, around the world, word for word. The FBI knew they had to get to Jewel before the news did, so agents tricked him into an interrogation under the guise of filming an instructional video for first responders. When they finally read Jewel his Miranda rights at the end of the interview,
he knows this is no longer a training video. And you just watch his face. We've seen the video of that. And you just watch his face just completely drop. It's a shocking moment for him. And at that moment, Richard Jewell's life will change forever.
And the thousands of reporters at the Olympics, they go with the story too. Think retweeting decades before social media was even a thing.
They repeat the stories or they amplify the stories in a way that's remarkably damaging.
So cameras are there when FBI agents cart boxes out of the Buford Highway apartment Richard shared with his mother, Bobby.
Mr. Jewell has been fully cooperative and permitted the agents to enter the apartment and conduct the court-authorized
Richard search. Jewell's life starts to become this cloistered, incredibly claustrophobic experience inside his mother's apartment.
It's a 9-hour search. They strip the place, mortifying Bobby as they rifle through her lingerie and haul off her Tupperware collection.
Mrs. Jewell, how's your son holding up?
He's watching television, and every channel has him as the lead suspect.
Richard Jewell becomes the punchline of jokes. Jay Leno calls him the Unabubba. The New York Post labels him a village Rambo, a fat, failed, wannabe cop who lives with his mother and can't hold down a job.
So in the court of public opinion, Richard Jewell is absolutely tried and convicted.
Meanwhile, law enforcement was still trying to build a case.
Evidence is present. This search is part of an ongoing investigative process and does not indicate in any way that Mr. Jewell has been charged with a crime under our system of justice.
The head of FBI himself, Louis Freeh, was personally overseeing the case, a level of oversight Kent Alexander had never seen.
Absolutely unheard of. But in this case, when you're the director of the FBI and you've had things like Waco go horribly wrong, you've had Oklahoma City, you want to make sure that things go right.
Jewell's newly assembled legal team begins making the rounds on the talk show circuit. They stage a press conference at the site of the payphone where the bomb scare was called in at 12:58 a.m., blocks away from Centennial Park, where Jewell found the knapsack at 12:57. The tactic worked, planting seeds of doubt in the minds of the public, and investigators were losing conviction too.
The more we reviewed, and we're talking hundreds of reports, the more it became apparent that there was as much showing that Richard Jewell did not do it as he did. So it was a matter of just looking through it through an objective prism. And as time went on, it became clearer and clearer that it just didn't look like he was the bomber.
Now, 3 weeks later, without sufficient evidence to charge him,
Richard Jewell remains under the watchful eye of the media.
Richard Jewell's attorneys put his mother, Bobby, in front of the media to plead with President Clinton on behalf of her son. So they arranged this news conference with lots of cameras pointed directly at Bobby. They'd reviewed with Bobby Jewell her statement time and again, again and again and again. She never was able to make it all the way through that statement without breaking down. On the very last run, the one that counted, she actually made it through the statement and then just broke down in tears completely. And it was a moment that resonated, I think, with the media, with the public, and even with law enforcement behind closed doors. It was hard not to take note of that and realize the toll that this has taken on Richard Jewell and his mom.
And so, nearly 3 months after the AJC published the story, Kent Alexander decided to set the record straight.
It was time, we thought, to make an unusual statement, a public statement about somebody's status at the Justice Department. Normally, if somebody's under investigation, you never talk about it. I wrote this letter. It's called a non-target letter. Technically, it just says you're not a target of the investigation, but the media took that as a full clearance, which was great. That was the hope. When it became clear that there was nothing forthcoming on Richard Jewell, the media started turning on its own.
And some government officials turned on the media. Here's North Carolina Republican House member Howard Coble in a congressional hearing about the FBI's conduct on the Jewell case.
If anyone is justified in being bitter and angry, it is you, sir, because you were recklessly yanked around and from pillar to post.
And Richard Jewell had his say.
Not only did the FBI accuse the wrong man, its agents in Atlanta and officials in Washington actively participated in publicly humiliating me and privately violating my constitutional rights. The media followed the FBI's lead.
Kathy Scruggs was crushed by the fallout from the story she'd so doggedly reported. Already suffering from a number of health problems, she died from an apparent drug overdose at the age of 42 in 2001. Scruggs never saw the apprehension of the real Centennial Park bomber, Eric Robert Rudolph. He detonated three more bombs, two in Atlanta and one at an abortion clinic in Birmingham, Alabama, and avoided capture, hiding out in the mountains of North Carolina for 5 years. Today, he spends most of his time alone in a concrete cell in a supermax prison. Richard Jewell went on to work as a police officer in Luthersville, Georgia. He even got married, and he died in 2006, 5 years after Scruggs, from complications from heart disease and diabetes. He was 44. 23 years later, some point to Jewell's experience as an early example of fake news, a media conspiracy to distort facts driven by a political agenda or to gin up ratings and click-throughs. Kent Alexander disagrees.
This is anything but fake news. I just don't understand that concept when it comes to this story. This is very real news. This is a real bomb, a real person. What happened to him happened. The story was true. It's more a question of how the media reports the news, but it's just simply not a fake news story.
Kevin Sowen.
And you can easily say mistakes were made by the FBI, mistakes were made by the media, and you can find evidence for some of that. Were there honest people trying to do honest things? Absolutely.
Alexander and Sowen found the initial reporting on Jewell was accurate. But Bert Rotin, that reluctant editor at the Journal Constitution in 1996, says even when reporters uncover facts, sharing them can be needlessly destructive.
The fact that you don't commit libel is a very low standard for a newspaper.
And, Rotin says, not much of a defense for what his paper did to Richard Jewell.
And the way that we thought about that story and the consequences from it informed me as a journalist and editor the rest of my life. I mean, I don't think a day went by when I walked in the AJC when I didn't think about that. And to I mean, we lose touch with the fact that we're writing about people. You do forget about that. You become focused on trying to tell the best story you can.
NBC, The New York Post, and CNN were sued by Jewel and settled. The AJC fought the suit all the way to the Georgia Supreme Court, finally prevailing in 2012. Tom Johnson, now retired president of CNN News, says if the pace of media in 1996 was dangerously fast for something as basic as human dignity, that pace has nothing on the speed of 21st century online news and social media.
I am very troubled by where we are today and perhaps even where we're headed. At this point, virtually anybody can get onto Facebook or get onto any other social media and pump out information that is false, that is harmful. I mean, it really is so damaging. I especially hope that young people will make the distinction between what is sort of available to them and yet what is truthful. And if I knew what to do, I'd be back in the business full time.
As it stands, Johnson has to live with the world he had a hand in building.
The mistake we made is something that I will take with me to my grave.
The AJC assigned a reporter to do a thorough investigation of the paper's role in turning the spotlight on Jewel. That piece never ran for fear of playing into the lawsuit. The FBI did its own review and decided the agency bore no responsibility for protecting the privacy of suspects. But the following year, Attorney General Janet Reno took the unusual step of publicly apologizing to Jewel. And how about the public that gobbled it up? The hunger for instant news, whether accurate or not, clearly didn't end when we learned Jewel was innocent. And so, 23 years later, what should we do? As we flick through self-curated news feeds, how much do we care about sorting fact from fiction? Kent Alexander and Kevin Salwin believe we owe Richard Jewel more than our regrets. After all, he saved lives in 1996.
I think what he did was amazing, and I hope he goes down as a hero. What happened to him was tragic, but he's just the person who really saved the Olympic Games in a lot of ways.
And Richard Jewel is the person who should have a statue of him in Atlanta.
There is no statue yet, but Centennial Olympic Park officials say they plan to place a marker honoring the man who was never arrested, never charged, but who proved more valuable as a suspect than a hero.
You know my name, but you do not really know who I am. My name is Richard Jewel.
Mistaken was produced by Grant Blankenship, Priya Mahadevan, and me, Virginia Prescott. Additional help from Allison Hashimoto and Sean Powers. Editing, mixing, and original music by Jesse Neiswanger. Executive producer, Mary Lynn Ryan. Audio used by permission from the Atlanta History Center and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Additional audio from CNN, NBC News, ESPN, The Associated Press, and ABC News. Special thanks to GPB's Mark Bradway and to Tom Johnson, Bert Roten, and to Kent Alexander and Kevin Salwin. You can find an extended interview with Kevin and Kent and more on their book, The Suspect, along with some articles, images, and streaming and podcast versions of this broadcast, all at gpb.org/Richard Jewel. This is GPB.